Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio. If you're listening to this broadcast on medium or shortwave in Europe or America, then this announcement is for you. As of July 1st, our programs will no longer be broadcast in these areas and on these frequencies. But they will still be available via satellite, on the internet, on demand and in podcast, and on local radio stations that rebroadcast them. For details, visit our website at vaticanradio.va.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature programme. Coming up in just a few moments, for the feast of St. John the Baptist, we find out more about the figure and the mission of this colourful biblical character. To coincide with the World Day for Refugees, we hear about a prayer vigil run by the St. Egidio community for all those who lose their lives trying to reach European shores. And Joan Lewis, our regular Vatican watcher, returns with details of what's been happening here in Rome and at an interfaith conference in the Tunisian capital. June the 24th marks the feast of the birth of St. John the Baptist, one of the most beloved of biblical figures, whose mission was to announce the Messiah and to prepare the way of the Lord. From the Gospels we learn how John preached in the Jordan Valley, how he urged his hearers to repent and be baptized, and how in due course he came to baptize Jesus in the waters of the River Jordan. John was executed by King Herod somewhere between AD 26 and 31 after publicly criticizing the king's second wife, Herodias. These are the bare bones of John the Baptist's life, but to find out more about the saint and his message, my colleague Susie Hodges spoke with Monsignor Paul Tai, Secretary of the Pontifical Council for Social Communications.
John the Baptist, I suppose, in many ways is the last of the great figures of the Old Testament. And yet he's there right at the beginning of the New Testament. So he's this kind of crucial figure in terms of the transition from the Old Testament to the New Testament. One of the great German theologians, Bornkamm, described him as a sentinel standing at the frontier between two aeons. And the other thing about him, I think, as a figure is he's an extraordinarily attractive figure. There's something very strange. He's a figure that has appealed to artists, has appealed to musicians, as a figure who captures the imagination. But in capturing the imagination of people, even in his own time, probably capturing their imagination with the strangeness of dress, with the exaggerated nature of his lifestyle, he always sought not that attention for himself, but to direct them and lead them towards Christ. So he's the last of the great figures, the great Old Testament prophets, pointing, leading us towards the Messiah.
And you said, you know, his interesting lifestyle. I mean, he was very austere, and this austere, solitary life in the desert. I mean, he's very much could be seen as a monk.
In many ways, would be seen as a kind of a precursor of a monk, the man who went out to the desert. The desert for the Jewish people would have been that area where there was barren. It was the place where there was no life. It's the place where, if you went, you had to depend completely and totally on God. And that, in a sense, is John the Baptist. He's the one who entrusts himself completely to his Lord. And that, again, is part of that type of figure will always appeal, I think, to people. The person who reminds them of something else. Not that all of us are going to make these radical choices, abandon our everyday lives, go off and do something extraordinary, heroic or different. But the fact that there are some who do that helps us to kind of maybe keep a perspective on our own existence and stop absolutizing the everyday, important in all as it is.
He's also been described as an anti-establishment figure. I mean, he hated hypocrisy, he warned of divine punishment for sinners, and he also, of course, didn't flinch at speaking out against people in high places, and that outspokenness cost him his life, didn't it?
Yeah, again, it's the figure of the prophet. The very strong prophet who fears nothing, who speaks the truth as he sees it and has no difficulty in facing the consequences of that. I think an image that I've been reading about and I think is nice is that John the Baptist was really one of the great figures of judgment. He pronounced judgment. In particular, he called people to repentance, to recognition of their own failings and weaknesses. Whereas Christ himself is more the figure of salvation. John the Baptist tells us where it's all gone dreadfully wrong, why we've all made mistakes, why it's all collapsing about us. Jesus then offers us the way out of that. He offers us the salvation, the possibility of being saved in the midst of that. So therefore, people would be very keen on trying to see John the Baptist not simply as a figure in himself, but always must be understood in relationship to Jesus. So without the message of Jesus, the salvation, the hope, the possibility of redemption, the preaching, the teaching of John the Baptist could be something perceived as very negative. In fact, the great German theologian Bonhoeffer used to talk about there was a choice in life. We could either despair or we could turn to Christ. And maybe if we'd been left alone with the message of John the Baptist, it might have been more towards a kind of a sense of being judged and being without hope. But his message was always to bring people to a realization of their need for Christ and for the salvation that Christ would offer.
And we see from the Bible, don't we, that Jesus thought very highly of John.
Jesus, very highly of John. And Jesus, in many ways, positioned his ministry as a response to some of the work of John. Jesus himself also picked up the message of repentance, repent and believe the good news. And this sense, I think people would say that John is a figure of continuing relevance, even though he may be seen as an Old Testament figure in some ways theologically. Many people would interpret him as a great figure, particularly for those who minister in the name of the church and for the church itself in its own ministry, that we must call people to a recognition of where there is failing, where there is weakness, where there is a lack of hope and trust in people's lives, but not just hold them there, not just leave them there without a response, but to bring them to the fullness of Jesus. Again, often people would say is that the minister, the priest, the preacher, in a sense, relies on his or her own personality to bring somebody, to attract somebody. But again, that's not just to hold them. It's not for ourselves. It's to lead them to Christ.
How ancient is his cult, as far as we know?
It's one of the very oldest. I was reading again. It seems that in Constantinople, at the earliest Christian times, there was something like 15 different churches dedicated to John the Baptist.
My thanks there to Monsignor Paul Tai, speaking with my colleague Susie Hodges. The UN's World Day for Refugees is marked worldwide on June the 20th each year. And here in Rome, for that occasion, a prayer vigil takes place for refugees and migrants who have lost their lives trying to reach European shores. Since 1990, over 18,000 people are known to have died on the dangerous journey from North Africa to Italy, Spain and Malta. Recent conflicts in North Africa and the Middle East have led many more people to embark on the risky sea crossing in dilapidated and overloaded boats. The true death toll is probably much higher. The evening prayer vigil at the Church of Santa Maria in Trastevere is organised every year by the lay Catholic community of Sant'Egidio and led by Cardinal Antonio Veglio, president of the Pontifical Council for the Pastoral Care of Migrants and Itinerant Peoples. My colleague Linda Bordoni spoke to Sant'Egidio's Cecilia Pani to find out more.
For more than 10 years, we in the community of Sant'Egidio have started to collect news about people who died mainly in the Mediterranean Sea.
Cecilia Pani is a member of the Sant'Egidio community, a movement of lay people dedicated to evangelization and charity. She's in charge of refugees and migrants.
Because we were struck about so many people dying and nobody could know anything about their story, their names. On the newspapers mainly was only about people coming to Italy like it was an invasion, a problem for southern Italy. And that's why we started to collect names and stories. And now we decided to do something in this occasion for the World Day of Refugee, to pray, to remember people who have disappeared, yes, and nobody can remember their names.
Now we're talking about men, women, children.
Yes, also babies. Families, entire families we have disappeared in the water, and most of them come from Africa, but also from Asia, from Turkey, from Afghanistan, from Pakistan, from China.
It's for these people that the community of Sant'Egidio Together with the Italian branch of the Jesuit Refugee Service, the Federation of Evangelical Churches in Italy, the Migrantes Foundation, and the National Caritas Organization, has organized the prayer service entitled Morire di Speranza, to die of hope.
Who are these people? What would you like to say about these people? So that we don't forget them.
They flew from their countries. Most of them are, well, refugees. They wanted to ask for asylum, but there are also people who escaped their country because of natural disasters. His Holiness Pope Paul VI called them economical refugees, a sort of people who escape their country not only because of political problems, but because their land give them no possibility to leave.
You have met many of the ones who did make it, because a lot of them end up here at Sant'Egidio. What do they bring with them? What wealth do they have for us?
I think the ones who can reach our country are the strongest, also the most intelligent, the people who have already overcome a lot of problems and a lot of difficulties. That's why I say they are the strongest ones, because you need money, you need courage, you need strength and good health to afford all this trip. In the last 10 years, I must say, in Italy we have less refugees, less people from Africa because of political choices. I'm talking about more difficulties in getting visas, and in general Europe has already closed its borders. But the ones who come really make us open our mentality, our eyes on the future, the real future of the world. That's why it's very important for us, for Europeans, not to get older as an old continent, but understand that our future is only with other people, and in particular people coming from Africa, because really the future of Europe is Africa. As long as the future of Africa is with Europe. I'm talking about the global aging of European population and the need we have of young people working. And also I'm talking about cultural awareness. Of course, Europe is a continent with a long history of culture, of important events, but now in the globalized world we can only go on if we don't close our borders.
These people, when they set out on their journeys, are they aware of the dangers that they are about to face? Do they know that they might lose their lives in the journey?
Yes, they do. Absolutely. And moreover, they pay a lot of money to do this. We can understand how desperate they are if we think that they try this terrible trip aware of all the dangers. And we know this because we met a lot of people who told us the history of their trip. Some of them have traveled for months on foot, by ship, and then in cars, in trains, by plane too, some of them.
Cecilia told me that general attention was catalyzed in 1999 when two young boys from Guinea-Conakry hid in the belly of an aeroplane in a tragic attempt to reach Europe. She remembers their names.
Yagin Koita and Fode Tonkara. They wanted to go to Europe to study, because in their country they couldn't go to school. Their bodies were discovered in Brussels many days later.
Let's remember these two boys, you said their names, but like them there are thousands of others.
I think we can do something to avoid this. I think we can, in Europe, we can work to help Africa in many ways, economically and politically, but this is not enough. I think there is place for these people coming to Europe. We need them. And instead of being scared of invasions, it would be better to avoid such deaths and to help them to cross the border in a more secure way, because the danger is not for us Europeans, but it's for them, for their life.
Thanks there to Cecilia Pani from the Sant'Egidio community, talking to my colleague Linda Bordoni. Now our regular guest Joan Lewis is back once again with details of what's been happening behind the scenes at the Vatican and at an interfaith conference that she attended in the Tunisian capital. Joan, welcome to our studios and welcome back to Rome, because you've been away again, haven't you, following a conference this past week?
Exactly. This was a conference organized by the Oasis Foundation, which was founded in 2004 by Cardinal Scola, who at the time was the Archbishop, the Patriarch of Venice. He's now the Archbishop of Milan. And he founded this organization to create dialogue between East and West, to make sure that dialogue will bring Muslims and Christians closer together, because you're talking about in the Middle East, in Northern Africa, you're talking about Christians being a minority in Muslim majority countries.
A very tiny majority.
A very tiny one and tiny in certain countries. And you have to look at these, as this conference did, look at the Islamization of certain countries, look at the constitutions of certain countries. Do they or do they not give rights to religious minorities? Obviously, another one would be the Jews and so forth, but there's many different Christian groups. And
this conference takes place 1 year in Italy, doesn't it?
It alternates between, it has up to now, between Venice and then a city usually Middle East or North Africa.
Tell us a bit about the theme for this meeting. What was the main focus of it?
Religion in a society in transition, how Tunisia challenges the West. And the interesting thing about this is in the view of the post-Arab Spring, depending on who you're talking to. And, of course, Cardinal Scola said that, you know, we are at a crossroads in the Arab Spring. But this particular theme looked at topics that do involve other countries in the Middle East and in North Africa, but they were taking the case of Tunis in particular. There was a debate on the new constitution. The president, as a matter of fact, unexpectedly did come to the conference on Tuesday. By the way, he's an interim president. He will be president until, I believe, it's next November, for a year. And it's very, very interesting. He gave a fascinating talk in French about the rights of people, the freedom of conscience, freedom of religion. He's very much a human rights activist. And I did ask somebody now, for example, if he does a really good job and the people are behind him, because Tunisia seems to be a much more open society, if people are really behind him, could he then run for president again? And they said, yes, he could.
So a strong focus on dialogue throughout the conference.
Yes, exactly, on dialogue. And as I say, so many of the topics, the new constitution in Tunisia, constitutions in other countries, comparing the religious freedom for the minorities in certain African countries. And then you also had not just Africa, but the quality of people at this conference. I'd love to think that the media was on top of something like this, because it is a very, very important issue. And even though we had a lot of priests and we had these bishops I mentioned, there was a huge, first of all, there were Muslims and there were Christians. And there was a huge number of lay people. So the input was extraordinary.
Certainly these conferences are very interesting. And I would say, particularly in light of what seems to be so often painted as a religious conflict between Christians and Muslims in Nigeria this week, we had Pope Benedict's urgent appeal for an end to the violence in that African country, didn't we?
After the Wednesday audience, exactly. I think I was on the plane or something as he was speaking these words, but as people know, after his general audience catechesis in Italian, a longer version, he gives a shorter version in other languages, and he did ask for an appeal for an end to the attacks that have taken place recently in Nigeria. And I must say, those have made a lot of headlines in newspapers. And these attacks aimed particularly at the Christian community, worshipers killed, churches being set on fire. And this is actually something that's ongoing. This was not just last week that this happened. But the Pope said, "I appeal to leaders for an immediate end to the killing of so many innocents. It's my hope the various components of Nigerian society will collaborate so as not to start down the path of revenge, and that all citizens will cooperate in building a peaceful and reconciled society in which everyone's right freely to profess their faith is fully protected." And you're absolutely right. This is just part of that tapestry we saw woven at this conference in Tunis.
And certainly the Nigerian church leaders there, we think of Archbishop Onaiyekin, very, very involved in trying to promote dialogue rather than this path of revenge and retaliation.
Just what the Holy Father said.
The other rather fun piece of news that came out of that Wednesday general audience, or came out on Wednesday, was the new car that the Vatican Press Office now has. The first, I believe, fully electric car made in Italy.
Exactly. It's by an Italian company, NWG, and I'm afraid my research did not extend to the meaning of those initials, which is interesting because there technically is no W in the Italian alphabet. In any event, this was an electric city car given to the Pope and will join the fleet of other vehicles that, of course, carry the papal seal. And this car can go 90 miles without any kind of a recharge. And after 5 hours, the battery will be able to go again. I'm sure they told the Pope that. And the company itself said they thought the Pope would be a good candidate to receive the car, considering his appeals for care for the environment, though they noted he will probably not be doing much driving himself. That would absolutely be the headline heard around the world. You know, Holy Father drives himself around St. Peter's Square.
A nice story, though, that I'm sure the secular press has been very interested in. Another story particularly interesting for Italians, and particularly in northern Italy, is the news that Pope Benedict himself will be touring the region of Emilia-Romagna, which was so badly hit by an earthquake a month ago.
Right. He's going to spend about a half a day there, and that's going to be on Tuesday, June 26th, and to visit the areas of the Italian region of Emilia-Romagna, terribly afflicted by an earthquake. It's going to be about a half a day visit. He's going to arrive by helicopter at a sports field, then be taken to visit certain areas.
And to meet with local people.
And to meet with the victims of the earthquake, obviously many of whom now homeless, and some jobless when you think of places they worked being also destroyed in the earthquake. And he'll be there till about 1 or 1:30 and then return to the Vatican by helicopter.
He has, of course, made several appeals already, hasn't he, for solidarity with the victims of this tragedy.
Sure. Gosh, Italy's really suffered the last few years with earthquakes of big and medium magnitude.
Going back to the Angelus, his Sunday Angelus address also contained an appeal, didn't it, for World Refugee Day that's been celebrated this week.
This, of course, is sponsored by the United Nations. There are many world days that are sponsored by them. And the Pope referred to the many people, especially families, forced to flee their lands because they're threatened by armed conflicts and serious forms of violence. And he said, "To these brothers and sisters who are so troubled, I assure the prayer and the constant concern of the Holy See, while I hope their rights are respected." Very important words there. "And that they may soon be reunited with loved ones." This was after, of course, he had recited the Marian prayer with the faithful in St. Peter's Square. And really, too, in that last part of his appeal, two things that we've seen the Vatican, the Holy See, the Holy Father say for years, and that is human rights should be respected everywhere by everybody. But certainly in the case of people who, against their will, are forced to flee and become refugees. One day you're a citizen, the next day you're a refugee. And so their rights, and then to be reunited with loved ones. This is often a problem of refugees, people being separated, and the breadwinner is in one place, the family is in another, and that's been respecting rights and reuniting families have been two major concerns over the years of the Holy See.
Sunday also marked the conclusion of the week-long International Eucharistic Congress that's been taking place in Dublin, in the Irish capital. And the Pope, in fact, had a message, didn't he? Or he had words about the closing of the Congress there.
He did, and I did have a chance in Tunis to speak to a very good friend, Father Rifat Bader from Jordan, who was there with 33 Jordanians, and he said it was like, I hate to use that word, he said, but awesome. And the Pope was not there, but he did send a video message, a pre-taped video message for the faithful. He received a standing ovation. People applauded like mad when they started the video and then, of course, afterwards. And obviously, the Pope talked about liturgy. He talked about the Eucharist because that's what this was. But I think more importantly for the Irish, he told the Irish, he said, you're heirs to a church that's been a mighty force for good in the world and that has given a profound and enduring love of Christ and His Blessed Mother to many, many, many others. He said, your forebears knew how to strive for holiness and constancy in their personal lives, how to preach joy that comes from the gospel, how to promote the importance of belonging to the universal church and communion with the See of Peter, and also to pass all of this on. Yet, said the Pope, thankfulness and joy at such a great history of faith and love have been shaken by, in an appalling way, by the revelation of sins committed by priests and consecrated persons against people entrusted to their care. And the Pope says, like, I mean, how do we explain this? That people who regularly received the Lord's body and confessed their sins in penance have offended others in this way. And he said, it remains a mystery. Yet evidently their Christianity was no longer nourished by the joyful encounter with Jesus Christ, especially, of course, in the Eucharist. He said it had become merely a matter of habit. Very, very. I actually read his homily several times. I mean, his address several times.
It was certainly going to the heart of the crisis powerful, facing the Irish Church at the moment and suggesting perhaps ways forward, how this conference can bear fruits in the future.
Exactly. And I think that's what we're going to want to keep our finger on the pulse of things happening in Ireland. And what will this Eucharistic conference, I think there were 80, 90,000 people at the final Mass, what will this conference bring to bear, especially in Ireland, as well as for all those who came from around the world to attend? But Ireland, the focal point at this moment of many big problems, and the Pope suggesting maybe here's what we have to do.
He also announced the next one will be held in the Philippines.
And yes, he announced that the next Eucharistic Congress, as they're held every 4 years, will be in the Philippines, Cebu. The Philippines in 2016. So knowing the Filipinos, they are right now as we speak building platforms and arranging to welcome a million people. It will be amazing.
For the moment, Joan, thank you very much for being with us. Until your next travels, we look forward to seeing you again here in studio.
God bless.
And Joan Lewis will be back on the air at this same time next week.
If you're listening to this broadcast on medium or shortwave in Europe or America, then this announcement is for you. As of July 1st, our programs will no longer be broadcast in these areas and on these frequencies, but they will still be available via satellite, on the internet, on demand and in podcast, and on local radio stations that rebroadcast them. For details, visit our website at vaticanradio.va.
And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English programme for today. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.